Another Point of View, a program which seeks to provide our listeners with thoughtful, insightful news and commentary from a range of political perspectives on current issues in the U.S. I'm Michael Howe.
And I'm Bob Golden. Together, we'll be reading selected articles from the online news service Tangle. Tangle is an independent, nonpartisan, and subscriber-supported media organization that covers the major political stories in the U.S. Tangle seeks to produce truly non-biased reporting on current events by providing responsible views from across the political spectrum in every single article, clearly labeling that what is opinion and what isn't.
It's important to note that the views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the article authors and publishers and not necessarily reflect the views of the Audio Journal, its staff, or the volunteer readers. With that introduction, let's dive into a couple of articles from the current news cycle. Here's Bob with our first article.
Thank you, Michael. Our first article for today's program comes from the Tangle newsletter of June 18th. U.S. signs deal with Iran. On Wednesday, June 17th, both the United States and Iran remotely signed a memorandum of understanding to end the war between the two countries after more than 100 days of conflict. The White House also announced the details of the 14-point plan, which included calls for the U.S. and Iran to allow passage through the Strait of Hormuz and commits the United States to facilitating a $300 billion reconstruction fund for Iran. The backup. The U.S. and Israel launched a coordinated military campaign against Iran on February 28, 2026. After more than 5 weeks of fighting, the two sides agreed to a ceasefire on April 7th. In the month since, the U.S. and Iran have each conducted sporadic military operations, including exchanging air strikes last week after an Iranian drone hit a U.S. helicopter. President Donald Trump had previously announced the agreement on Sunday, calling it a great deal before heading to the G7 summit in Ivalon-les-Bains, France. What's in it? The deal includes 14 individual items. For trade, Iran will immediately open the Strait of Hormuz without tolls for 60 days, with shipping volumes returning to pre-war levels within 30 days, and the U.S. will lift its naval blockade in parallel. On Iran's nuclear program, Iran reaffirms it will not pursue a nuclear weapon, while the U.S. agrees not to impose new sanctions or deploy additional forces in the region, pending a final deal. For oil production, the U.S. agrees to allow Iran to resume exports of crude oil and petroleum products and unfreeze Iran's assets. The U.S. will also develop a $300 billion reconstruction project in cooperation with unspecified regional partners in the Middle East. Separately, the MOU states that the ceasefire will extend to Lebanon, although Israel has said that the deal will not obligate it to pull its forces out of the country. Israel conducted airstrikes on Lebanon yesterday, killing at least three people. President Trump has described the deal as achieving 99.9% of his goals of preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, pointing to Iran's reaffirmation in the MOU that will not produce one. Iran has confirmed the details of the plan, but Iranian spokesman Ismaili Baghdadi emphasized Lebanon's sovereignty and territorial integrity were integral to the deal. After the details were released, many U.S. legislators were critical. We get a deal that just reopens the strait that was already open before he started the war? How is that a win? Said Rep. Seth Moulton, Democrat of Massachusetts. History teaches that giving billions of dollars to theocratic lunatics who want to murder us is a bad idea, Senator Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas, said. Today we'll share arguments from the political left and right, followed by senior editor Will Kabach's take on the deal. Here's Michael with the views from the political left.
Thanks, Bob. Here is what many on the political left are saying. The highlights. The left calls the deal a failure, with many saying it will define Trump's legacy. Some criticized Trump for forsaking his promise to the Iranian people. Others argue the deal heralds a shift in the world order. In The Nation, David Ferris called the deal total humiliation for Trump. Ferris wrote, "The deal represents a humiliating strategic defeat and immediately ends the Islamic Republic's long international isolation with virtually no concessions from Tehran whatsoever. While U.S. officials failed to broker any serious linkage between Iran's nuclear program and aid resumption, Tehran achieved a linkage breakthrough of its own. Iranian negotiators tied the negotiating window to stopping Israel's reckless bombing attacks in Lebanon. Once Iran succeeded in keeping the Strait of Hormuz closed with minimal effort, and once the U.S. gave up on any attempt to force it open with history's most powerful navy, Tehran realized it held all the cards. Shielded from military reprisals and with a promise from the United States to, quote, respect each other's sovereignty and territorial integrity and to refrain from interfering in each other's internal affairs, close quote, Iran is now well on the road to regional hegemony. Trump will now have to live with the reality that, for all of the horrific long-term damage he has inflicted on the United States and its political system, the debacle in Iran may be the humiliating foundation of his legacy." In MS Now, Holly Dagress said Trump abandoned the Iranian cause. Dagress wrote, "Anti-regime Iranians have been on an emotional roller coaster for months. Protests that began in late December turned into a bloody January uprising in which security forces killed thousands of civilians. President Donald Trump urged the Iranian people on January 13th to keep protesting, promising that help is on the way. Meanwhile, they watched as U.S. officials negotiated with the regime that had slaughtered fellow Iranians, including children, and even said they would be honored to meet those leaders. As the conflict continued, Iran's civilian infrastructure has been increasingly damaged, not just the accidental U.S. strike on an elementary school in Manab, but also, more recently, drinking water structures. The economic consequences for Iranians have also been severe. The conflict is estimated to have cost at least 1 million Iranian jobs. The war and the border and the broader U.S. treatment of Iran issues have left many in and outside Iran wondering whether the U.S. remains committed to supporting the Iranian people at all." In Bloomberg, Andreas Kluth said, "America's loss to Iran will unravel geopolitics." Kluth wrote, "For the world as a whole, the ramifications of this stalemate will be just as large. America's war against Iran differs from Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. But the two conflicts have this in common. In each case, the president of an erstwhile superpower attacked a second-rate power and failed to defeat it. One result is that America and Russia, in different ways, will come out of their wars of choice exhausted and diminished. A third power, China, has, of course, been watching this slow but accelerating self-sabotage by America and Russia, and its leader, Xi Jinping, is seeing his assumptions confirmed. One is that Moscow will be no more than a junior partner to Beijing, useful in balancing against the U.S., but no match in any non-nuclear arena of power, economic, technological, political. Another is that America is in a secular decline, which will leave China stronger as long as it conserves its own resources. Next up, Bob has what the political right is saying.
Thanks, Michael. Turning now to what the political right is saying. The highlights. The right is mixed, though many suggest Trump lost out in the deal. Some say the deal allows the U.S. to adjust its Middle East strategy. Others predict Vice President Vance will take the fall if the deal falls through. The New York Post editorial board said the deal gives the Islamic Republic big wins up front and America nothing. The board wrote, "At best we can tell, the deal does nothing to achieve the aims America started the war with, but does hand Tehran a whole series of gains. Iran gets at least a few billion in immediate funds and can start selling oil right away, with at least some other sanctions dropped as well. Moreover, Tehran wins unprecedented authority over the Strait of Hormuz and likely locks in Hezbollah's dominance of Lebanon." Let's recall our goals. The Prez opened combat, seeking to permanently end Iran's nuclear threat and also eliminate its missiles and other offensive capabilities. And we also hoped for regime change. The bombing set back Iran's nuke programs, took out a lot of missiles and missile factories, and decapitated some of the regime's top leadership. All the talks since the start of April have done nothing more, indeed, have only let new Iranian leaders rebuild and regroup, even as the populace suffers. It seems to us that the team Trump doesn't want to use force to open the strait. It's panicking over oil prices and the midterms. It just wants to forget its promises to help the Iranian people. In the American conservative, Eldar Mammadov suggested the deal could help transform America's Mideast strategy. Mammadov wrote, "The deal has far wider geopolitical ramifications than a transactional ceasefire. That is, because it reveals the limits of American power and opens a path to a long overdue U.S. strategic recalibration in the Middle East. This outcome need not be seen as catastrophic. It can instead produce a realistic reassessment of American presence and partnership in the Middle East. The strategic opportunity is now visible. The deal allows the United States to do what it should have done a decade ago, recalibrate its regional posture downward while ensuring that no single power, Iranian, Saudi, Turkish, or Israeli, dominates the Gulf. The primary responsibility for regional security would likely shift to an alignment of regional powers. These states have the economic weight, military capacity, and dramatic relationships with Tehran to manage the regional framework without direct American combat involvement." In The Spectator, Freddie Gray asked, "Will the Iran deal destroy J.D. Vance?" Gray wrote, "Both Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, though keen to show their commitment to Trump's agenda, have tried to distance themselves from his unpopular war and its ramifications on their presidential ambitions. The difference is that Rubio has privately expressed reservations about negotiating with the Iranians, whereas Vance has become the front man of the ongoing peace process. This week, he has appeared on almost every American news channel, selling the MOU as Iran's last chance to come in from the dramatic cold. If the deal collapses, or is widely seen as a humiliation for America, Vance will be dismissed as a foreign policy dunce. It's notable that the odds on him becoming the next Republican presidential nominee are lengthening, while Rubio's have shortened. Sources close to Vance have let it be known he is now considering not running in 2028. Trump's war seems destined to force a painful reckoning over America's relationship with its closest ally in the Middle East, Israel, and Vance or Rubio may well have to deal with that. We'll conclude this article with Michael reading the Tangle editor's take.
And now we'll wrap up this first article with senior editor Will Kaulbach's take on this memorandum of understanding. The highlights. If the MOU holds, the U.S. will have achieved none of its core objectives in this war. Trump appears to be backing down in a way he hasn't before. Iran is poised to emerge from this war emboldened and more powerful. I don't know about you, but my head is spinning after this past week, trying to parse the tonal shifts, contradictory messaging, and lack of transparency from the Trump administration about peace negotiations with Iran has felt like solving 10 jigsaw puzzles whose pieces are mixed up together in a single box. Now, finally, we have access to the text of a memorandum of understanding, which is not actually a deal, but a starting point for negotiations on a lasting deal that could still fall apart if those future discussions stall. Okay, my head is still spinning. For some time now, the administration has clearly been drifting away from its goals in Iran. They communicated those goals in contradictory and uncertain terms at the beginning of the conflict, but they eventually landed on a core set of objectives: destroy Iran's missile arsenal, destroy its navy, ensure it can never obtain a nuclear weapon, and end the threat posed by its proxies in the Middle East. On the first count, the United States credibly degraded a significant portion of Iran's missile arsenal, especially early on. However, based on reporting from several outlets in the past month, Iran's stockpile is currently about 70% of its pre-war level. The U.S. government denied these reports, but it hasn't publicly issued its own assessment. The MOU says nothing about the arsenal either, and Trump himself suggested on Wednesday that it would be, quote, unfair, close quote, for Iran not to have some missiles. On the second count, the administration met its goal in technical terms, as Iran's navy was severely hampered within 2 weeks of the war's start. Tactically, however, this achievement hasn't been meaningful. Iran was able to leverage the Strait of Hormuz by mining the waterway, a move that could continue to disrupt shipping even after the war formally ends. Despite the naval losses, Iran's, quote, mosquito fleets, close quote, small unconventional military flotillas, have continued to wreak havoc in the strait, using a kind of marine guerrilla warfare to disrupt traffic as they please. Third, the state of Iran's nuclear program, ostensibly the core issue of this war, is uncertain. But we are a long way off from the complete obliteration President Trump claimed last year's U.S. strike on Iran nuclear facilities already achieved. After the war began in February, the administration told us time and again that eliminating Iran's nuclear threat was an absolute priority. But has the war brought that goal any closer? The MOU amounts to a promise that Iran will not procure or develop nuclear weapons, hardly binding and hardly reassuring. The president even undermined this position on Wednesday, implying it isn't fair that Iran's neighbors can possess enriched uranium when Iran can't. Finally, Iran-backed groups, particularly Hamas and Hezbollah, remain active in the region. While fighting in Gaza has declined, Hamas has not disarmed, and reporting from this week indicates that it doesn't plan to. Separately, the MOU explicitly states that military activity will cease on all fronts, including Lebanon, where Israel has continued carrying out airstrikes targeting Hezbollah. The text of the agreement notably highlights the, quote, territorial integrity and sovereignty of Lebanon, close quote, which feels like a clear warning to Israel to stand down, especially when paired with Trump's recent comments criticizing Israel's airstrikes. Meanwhile, the Houthis, another armed group backed by Iran, threatened last week to attack Israeli ships in the Red Sea. Considering the U.S. position at the start of the war, these developments boggle the mind. It's not hyperbole to say that President Trump has backed off from or completely reversed his position on all of the core issues as he used to justify attacking Iran. But that's not all. The MOU confirms reports that the U.S. will help develop a $300 billion reconstruction fund for Iran, unfreeze its assets, and allow it to immediately resume exporting oil, despite the State Department reportedly telling Congress on Tuesday that Iran uses these oil exports to fund terrorism. And the deal will eventually roll back all U.S. sanctions against Iran. In return, Iran will employ its best efforts to allow ships to transit the Strait of Hormuz without a toll for 60 days. In other words, the pre-war status quo, except that the strait is now full of mines and Iran could start charging a fee later. These lopsided terms have triggered a remarkable deluge of criticism from the president's hawkish supporters in the media and Congress. Fox News' Trey Gowdy said, "We had total control over that country. When you're in that position, you negotiate from strength. You don't give people money." The Daily Wire's Ben Shapiro called it a disaster. And commentator Batya Unger Sargon wrote, "The greatest superpower to ever exist, brought to its knees by a few minds. Just a disaster for America." These criticisms underscore a larger point. Throughout President Trump's second term, his core agenda items have all stalled. The Supreme Court struck the reciprocal tariffs down. The deaths of Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis forced leadership changes in immigration enforcement. And deportation numbers continue to lag behind the president's lofty goal. Now, the Iran war has derailed his foreign policy. Trump has still found avenues through which to enact tariffs and carry out deportations. The administration has pursued alternate legal routes to impose duties and recently locked in $70 billion in funding for ICE and CBP through Congress's reconciliation bill. But in this war, he's waving the white flag and backing off rather meekly. Consider just a few of his comments at the G7 summit in France last week. Quote, "The alternative to this deal would be a worldwide depression," close quote, he said. Regarding Iran's monetary assets, he said, quote, "We have taken a lot of Iran's money. It's not our money. It's their money. And we froze it. At a certain point in time, I guess we're going to have to give it back," close quote. With respect to world oil reserves, he said, quote, "Without this deal, we run out of oil reserves at about 4 weeks. The one thing I didn't want to see is economic catastrophe. If you kept this going, that could have happened," close quote. At the time of the war, pointing out the economic risks was a common talking point from the left. Now, the president himself has adopted that talking point about a war he started. These admissions suggest Iran will carry substantial leverage into the next stage of negotiations, and they lay bare the administration's lack of a coherent war strategy. Make no mistake, Iran's restriction of the Strait of Hormuz was the decisive move of this conflict, one we did not appear prepared for or capable of countering, despite the administration insisting otherwise. Of course, the war is not necessarily over. Future negotiations could fall apart, and the U.S. could resume its attacks in some form. As our own managing editor Ari Weitzman noted on Monday, the MOU doesn't resolve the conditions of the conflict, which implies the conflict may persist. But without the ability to control movement through the strait, we'll just be back in the same place we are today. no matter how many Iranian leaders we kill or how many military sites we destroy. No masterstroke is coming. The Trump administration is just boxed in. As someone who doubted the justifications for this war from the start and felt its execution has been haphazard, I admit to feeling some schadenfreude at this outcome, particularly after the degree of bluster about our path to overwhelming victory in the first few weeks, and Trump's confidence that he could easily negotiate an Iran deal superior to the Obama administration's. But then I remember the U.S. service members killed in the conflict and the many others wounded. I remember the Iranian civilians killed, including more than 100 school children, in what was almost certainly an errant U.S. missile strike. I remember that the Iranian regime, a repressive and violent government that murders its own people and thirsts for the destruction of the United States, is on the verge of emerging from this war richer and more influential in the Middle East. If the war is indeed over, I'll be relieved, but I find little to take solace in beyond that. What was this all for? Cynicism aside, we should be clear on one thing. If this MOU is indeed the beginning of the end of this war, then the war was a failure for the United States. We have not achieved our goals, and our adversary is likely to emerge from the conflict stronger than before. The costs in lives and dollars have been high, and we haven't even begun the now planned reconstruction. The world is a more dangerous, unstable place than it was before February 28th. And in all likelihood, the U.S. taxpayer will be left picking up the pieces and footing the bill for this administration's mistakes long after President Trump's term is over. Now, please stay tuned to Audio Journal. We'll be back with a second engaging article after this brief pause.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead.
You are listening to Another Point of View, a production of the Audio Journal.
Our second and final article for today's program is from the Tangle newsletter of June the 23rd. Democratic Socialists Headline Races Across the Country. Ahead of the 2026 midterm elections, candidates aligned with the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, have broken through in primary races for local and national seats. Headlined by figures like Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, and Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat of Michigan, Democratic Socialist candidates have challenged incumbents in strongly Democratic areas, seeking to pull the party toward more progressive positions on key issues. The backdrop. Democratic Socialists believe in the political philosophy of socialism, which holds that the state should redistribute wealth and take an active role in societal issues. Unlike socialists or communists, Democratic Socialists advocate for these goals through the democratic process rather than revolution. DSA traces its origins to the early 1970s, when its leaders organized in opposition to the Vietnam War and, later, the rise of Ronald Reagan. Today, DSA describes its mission as replacing capitalism with a democratic socialist system, exemplified by policies such as single-payer Medicare for all, defunding the police, and the Green New Deal. In addition to Ocasio-Cortez, Tlaib, and Sanders, New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani, Democrat, has emerged as one of the faces of DSA in the United States. Mamdani defeated former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo in the city's mayoral primary last year, then defeated him again when Cuomo ran as an independent in the general election. Since then, Mamdani has endorsed DSA candidates in local and federal elections in New York City, including Claire Valdez and Diarielza Avila Xavier, who is challenging a five-term incumbent Democrat in New York's 13th Congressional District primary this Tuesday. Separately, last Thursday, DSA endorsed Janice Lewis George, won the Democratic Party primary for mayor of Washington, D.C., making her the presumptive favorite to win in the general election in the heavily Democratic city. Lewis George won the primary by over 18 points, with particularly strong results at polling sites where over 60% of the population is under 35 years old. The week prior, President Donald Trump said the federal government may intervene in Washington, D.C.'s operations if Lewis George becomes mayor. Elsewhere, in the Los Angeles mayoral election, DSA City Council member Nathim Rahman advanced to a runoff against Mayor Karen Bass, setting up a general election race between the progressive challenger and the incumbent Democrat. In Maine, Graham Plattner, a progressive Democrat who previously aligned himself with DSA, recently won the state's Democratic Senate primary. Today, we'll explore the rise of the DSA and the DSA-aligned candidates in the United States with views from the political left and the right. Then, senior editor Will Kalbeck gives his take on this political trend. First up, here's Bob with the opinions from the political left.
Thank you, Michael. Let's start with what those on the political left are saying. The highlights. Many on the left suggest Democrats should embrace new candidates. Some argue that socialist policies will continue to be popular among urban constituencies. Others warn that the far-left candidates can't successfully run in competitive races. In the New York Times, Matthew Iglesias argues the Democrats need a candidate shakeup. Iglesias wrote, "The 2024 elections show that the party is simply not large enough to command a majority of the country. Building a newer and hopefully larger tent requires a different set of skills, more willingness to jeopardize parts of the existing coalition, more outsider personnel, and ultimately someone willing to run the kind of risky underdog campaign that put Donald Trump and Barack Obama in the White House. Rebuilding the party and bringing in new people with less investments in things as they are will help the party decide what it is about, which policy commitments are genuinely central, and which merit flexibility or abandonment. Moving in the direction of fresher faces is going to necessarily mean more ideological conflict rather than less. The process will be contentious and will make existing party leaders uncomfortable." In the American Prospect, Harold Mayerson described why cities go socialist. Mayerson wrote, "Mandani's, Lewis's George, and Rahman's political base isn't confined to DSA members. The two issues that both Mandani and Lewis George most stressed were making child care and home affordable. Issues that all but define the politics of young city residents. Issues that highlight the market's failure of current American capitalism and the need for higher taxes on the wealthy to provide badly needed social necessities. Which is why the future of most American big cities, most certainly those that attract young residents, is likely to be social democratic and often run by avowed socialists. The Bernies, Mandanis, and AOCs won't be the Democratic Party's lonesome ends. They'll be the party's urban wing. The sooner the Democrats understand that, and the sooner they embrace many of that wing's policies, however they choose to label them, the better." In CNN, Ronald Bromstein said this year's primaries are reshaping the Democratic Party. Brownstein wrote, "The struggle over control of the Democratic Party's direction has roared to new heights this year. These confrontations have not produced a knockout victory for either side. On balance, though, the left so far has outpointed the center in these contests, an advantage it could widen if several Mondani-endorsed congressional candidates win in New York, as is expected. But Democratic centrists correctly point out that a significant majority of the successful progressive primary candidates are winning in safely Democratic areas. In the competitive seats that will decide control of the House and Senate, the party still largely relies on moderate nominees. And for those candidates, the left's rise, even in safe seats, could prove an unwelcome complication. In reliably blue places, Democratic primary voters can support the most liberal candidates without worrying if they will win the general election. In the races that count most, electability remains likely to trump ideology." Next, here's Michael with the viewpoints from those on the political right.
Thank you, Bob. And now we turn to what many on the political right are saying. The highlights. Many on the right are concerned about DSA candidates' growing influence. Some predict that support for progressive politicians will wane once they start governing. Others say socialist policies don't work without force. In the Daily Signal, Jared Stepman suggested the Democratic base wants full-throated leftism. Stepman wrote, "Democrats are quickly moving away from denying their socialist connections to openly embracing them. That's a lesson to be learned from a clear trend taking hold in America's most populous blue bastions. The Democratic Party has lurched so far to the left that in its most secure bastions, it's being taken over by open socialists and Marxists. And there seems to be little resistance. They are using the enthusiasm and organization of groups like the Democratic Socialists of America to out-hustle and replace the old party establishment. And so far, it's working, at least in places that Democrats already comfortably control. They are now going to lean into the ideas like wealth and property confiscation, into the concept of borderless society that rejects any kind of immigration law enforcement, into many of the radical ideas that the party may have wished but for shrewdly kept quiet about. If this trend continues, they soon won't be the insurgents anymore. They'll be the establishment. They'll have the control of a national party with a very clear goal of finally bringing socialism to every corner of the country." In the Washington Post, Megan McArdle said, wait for reality to settle in. McArdle wrote, "It is a heady moment for the left because socialism's tainted brand has recovered from the vivid failures of the Soviet Union. The challenge is that socialism's rise is spiky, concentrated in blue cities where affluent but often downwardly mobile college graduates cluster. That's a problem for the Democratic Party, where the excesses of progressive government are helping to make the party's brand toxic in the less true blue areas. But it's also a challenge for the socialists because cities are the hardest places to execute big plans for new taxing and spending. Socialists may wax lyrical about a Nordic-style welfare state, but those states are paid for by heavily taxing the middle class, an idea that is unlikely to gain much purchase with the educated base of the Democratic Socialists of America. Today's college-educated elite is voting for more public services, not less disposable income." In The Hill, Emzari Gelashvili argued, "Most Democrats are frighteningly wrong about socialism." Gelashvili wrote, "At protests across American cities, demonstrators have carried Soviet flags, the hammer and sickle on red cloth, as symbols of resistance. I am not going to answer them with statistics or economic theory. I will instead tell them my family's story. In February 1951, my grandfather's family was loaded onto a cattle car with hundreds of others. Many people were beaten with rifle butts. A young man, maddened by thirst, at one point jumped from his wagon to reach water from a stream. Soldiers shot him on the spot. Most Americans associate socialism with equality and government services, not with deportation lists, sealed cattle wagons, or children hauling earth until they die of heat. But socialism in practice does not work without force and brutality, even if you give it nice adjectives like democratic. Socialism is not really a policy or an economic system. It is not Scandinavian. It is a machine whose only function is to destroy anyone sufficiently capable, principled, or stubborn enough to threaten those who operate it. It does this legally, bureaucratically, and, when necessary, with bullets. And finally, we'll conclude the article with the Tangle editor's take. Here's Bob.
Thanks, Michael. Here is senior editor William Kabach's take on this political trend within the Democratic Party. The highlights. I understand why this new crop of candidates promising radical change is exciting voters. The rise of democratic socialism is both a product of and a response to the MAGA movement. I'm unsure whether DSA can keep building its influence, but we'll find out soon. 10 years ago, I would have proudly told anyone who would listen that I was a democratic socialist. Allow me to take you back. One wintry Midwest afternoon in January 2016, when I was a senior in high school, I was riding in the back of a coach bus rumbling along I-35 from Minneapolis to Des Moines, chattering away with my politically inclined classmates. We were participating in a school program that brought interested students to the Iowa caucuses in presidential election years. For 3 days, we canvassed for a candidate of our choice, attended rallies for Democratic and Republican candidates, and observed the proceedings on caucus night. I chose to spend my time with the Bernie Sanders campaign. By happenstance, reporter Ruth Marcus chose to follow my group for a story while we door-knocked, and a picture of my classmates and me lived above the fold of the Washington Post homepage when her article published. It was all very cool. Coolest of all for me was the chance to get out the vote for Bernie. For months leading up to the trip, I had become enamored with the Vermont senator and his calls for reducing wealth inequality, reforming the healthcare system, and pursuing more aggressive strategies to combat climate change. I also like that he unapologetically called himself a democratic socialist, and I thought people who viewed that label negatively just didn't understand what it really meant. It doesn't mean like socialism. Socialism, I'd say, is just about electing people who want things to be fairer for everyone. On caucus night, I was in the front row at Sanders' rally and shook his hand after he spoke, full of hope that this moment was the start of a bigger thing to come. Today, I no longer see myself as part of the movement, and I'm a lot less assured in my political views than I was back in high school. Still, I understand the draw of democratic socialists popping up around the U.S. For many voters, particularly younger ones, socialism isn't the boogeyman it used to be. In fact, many prefer it to capitalism. Plus, the past year offers plenty of them to be excited about. Aside from Bernie's enduring influence, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a likely 2028 presidential candidate. Zohan Mamdani is confidently leading New York City. And in just the past few weeks, Democratic Socialist candidates have excelled in primaries in Los Angeles and D.C. In contemporary U.S. politics, once disqualifying labels matter less than ever. Branding President Trump a felon did nothing to stop him from winning re-election. Graham Platner, Democrat, and Ken Paxton, Republican, just won high-profile Senate primaries despite well-publicized and wide-ranging controversies. This dynamic, pitted with contempt for the second Trump administration and dissatisfaction or outright disgust with mainstream Democrats' response to it, has created a fertile ground for Democratic socialists to gain a foothold. Is DSA a response to the MAGA movement? Yes and no. The two movements have undeniable similarities. Both are, at root, economic populist movements. Both seize on an anti-establishment framing, the swamp, and globalists on one side, the billionaire class and corporate elites on the other. Both have effectively leveraged simple, repeatable phrases to galvanize their bases. Build the wall, America first, Medicare for all, tax the rich, and so on. Both frame their movements in binary terms, patriots versus traitors or workers versus billionaires. And both enjoy a certain zeal in taking on institutions once viewed as political power brokers, the media, the experts, the National Party leadership. The differences, of course, are stark. MAGA sees most issues through a national identity lens, while Democratic Socialists filter their worldwide view through class inequity. Additionally, while the movement may have borrowed some from the MAGA's playbook, or vice versa, it is ultimately working towards very different goals. And perhaps most saliently, Democratic Socialism is not defined by a single political leader, but rather a nationwide network of candidates at all levels of government. All of this leaves me conflicted when assessing DSA's trajectory in this political moment. On one hand, we need to be careful not to extrapolate our senses of the national mood from the result of local elections in deep blue areas. Candidates like Darlisa Avila Chevalier and Claire Valdez in New York haven't even secured nominations yet, while Nina Rahman is still an underdog against Karen Bass in Los Angeles. New York City and Seattle have Democratic Socialist mayors, with Washington, D.C. almost certainly soon to follow. But these are places where more progressive candidates already succeed. And as Megan McArdle noted, under What the Right is Saying, politicians are often forced to trade idealism for pragmatism once they have power, which can lead to disillusionment and infighting within movements that prize ideological purity. On the other hand, these urban centers are the most populous places in the country, and millions of people rally around these politicians could represent the early signs of an earnest political shift. The Democratic Party appears ripe for a shakeup, and DSA candidates' messaging seems to be resonating with the party's most engaged voters, particularly on immigration, Israel, and health care. Here again, the MAGA movement is instructive. How many Republican politicians felt a false sense of security heading into 2016, thinking GOP voters would never roll the dice on someone as risky as Trump? I get the sense that Democratic voters are equally dissatisfied with their party leadership as Republicans were in 2016. They're happy to look elsewhere. Electability be damned. Take Graham Plattner, who isn't DSA, but whose messaging is similar. I've spoken with several friends in Maine who said they happily cast a Democratic primary ballot for the embattled oyster farmer because they think he can provide a necessary jolt to a system they feel is increasingly overrun with corruption and controlled by elderly lawmakers clinging to power. I can understand that position. But like I said, I'm conflicted. A part of me, that 18-year-old self, hungers for something, anything new on the left. Another part, call it my tangled brain, thinks the Democratic Socialist movement isn't representing something new, but a continuation of a form of ideologically rigid politics that's contributed to our current division and won't help us get back on track. Those dueling feelings also suggest two potential pathways for DSA candidates in the incoming months. In the first, the movement continuously gains momentum with bold ideas on housing, in particular bringing broader attention and support. In New York, Mondani has released a plan to build 200,000 new homes in the next decade. And Valdez, his potential ally in Congress, has put forward proposals to create a federal housing developer and National Housing Construction Fund. These aren't overnight solutions, but they strike me as the kind of bold thinking that could garner attention and support. If TSA becomes associated with housing policy reform in the way that MAGA became associated with stronger immigration enforcement, its candidates could gain traction beyond blue cities. Again, labels matter less than ever. Voters might not care about the Democratic socialistic tag if they think a candidate has good ideas on housing affordability. In 2016, Trump's huge rally turnouts and polling strength in early primary states were harbingers of his eventual success. Right now, Sanders and AOC are drawing large crowds of their own in their fighting oligarchy tour, and not just in big Democratic cities. The turnout for these large-scale gatherings is another signal to pay attention to. Pathway 2 is what I might call the woke trap. TSA and its candidates unabashedly embrace progressive social policies like transgender rights, policy reform, and abolishing ICE. At the national level, voters appear to reject those policies in 2024, and I don't think much has changed since then. Even with the unpopularity of the Trump administration, I don't see evidence of a national appetite for this kind of social progressivism. Just look at how James Tallarico is trying to distance himself from 2020-era comments about religion and gender in the Texas Senate race. These candidates won't be able to sell their economic vision if they're constantly having to account for their social views. Furthermore, the organization is constantly preoccupied with internal disputes and ideological purity tests. Just look at how AOC, the most promising DSA politician in the country, has been forced to fend off attacks from some within the organization who see her as selling out to the mainstream. Ultimately, the DSA movement has to win elections to remain relevant. And I'm not convinced they're serious enough about making strategic compromises to succeed at the national level. The 2026 midterms haven't happened yet, but they're fast approaching. And we'll soon have a clearer picture of where DSA stands. Republicans unlocked their populist moment 10 years ago, and the conditions today are ripe for an equal and opposite reaction from the other side of the aisle. Over the next few months, we'll better understand whether the Mandanis and Rahmans were canaries in the coal mine or deep blue outliers.
For today's program, we have a special feature of a recent question posed by a subscriber from Wisconsin. The Q&A was featured in the Tangle newsletter of June the 16th. Now, here's Bob with that Q&A.
Question from subscriber CBW from Wisconsin. I thought that Israel was part of our attack on Iran, but since the war started, it seems like Israel has been focusing on Lebanon. I also heard Israel was not part of the negotiations between Iran and the U.S. How does Israel fit into the war with Iran? Tangle editor's answer. It's probably more accurate to think of the current war in Iran as two conflicts at the same time. The war against the Iran itself and the war against Iran's proxies, particularly Hezbollah in Lebanon. In fact, as we discussed yesterday, whether or not the current memorandum of understanding between the U.S. and Iran includes Israel or Hezbollah is a point of contention and controversy. As Abdalaram al-Rashad wrote in Arab News, having a peace plan applied to Hezbollah could make Hezbollah a recognized and protected actor, noting the same could apply to the Houthi militant group in Yemen. The U.S. and Israel share a desire to block Iran from having a nuclear weapon. But Israel's fight against Hezbollah isn't one that the U.S. has joined. In fact, Israel has been fighting an all-out war against Iran's proxies going back to its response to Hamas' attack on October 7, 2023. Hamas and Hezbollah have been Israel's target since day one, and the Yemeni Houthis have been involved for nearly as long. For that reason, Israel does not want to cease fire with Iran to constrain its efforts against Hezbollah, which it says is threatening its citizens in northern Israel, which we should add, is fighting in part by targeting residential neighborhoods outside of Beirut. With respect to Iran, other than a retaliatory strike on June 7th after an Iranian attack, Israel has been adhering to the April 7 ceasefire and not engaging in direct action. That doesn't mean that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu considers Israel's conflict with Iran to be a mission accomplished, but it does mean that he's treating that front separately from Israel's full-scale fight against Iranian proxy groups.
That concludes our program for today. We hope you have enjoyed listening to Another Point of View, a program that gives a voice to both sides of the debate on current events and important contemporary issues. This program is a production of the Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the article authors and publishers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Audio Journal, its staff, or the volunteer readers. Archived editions of this or any previous program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or by using the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device.
We've been reading original copyrighted material from the news service Tangle with their express permission. Tangle is an award-winning media organization that covers the major political stories in the U.S. It is independent, nonpartisan, and subscriber-supported, with a newsletter read by over 400,000 people in 55-plus countries across the world, and a podcast that reaches hundreds of thousands of listeners every month. Their audience is made up of conservatives, liberals, independents, and those who don't identify with any particular political tribe. Free podcasts can be heard on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. In addition to their free email newsletter, news articles, and podcasts, Tangle also provides a variety of rich subscriber-only content, including special news articles, in-depth investigative reports, and interviews with current newsmakers. To learn more about Tangle and find out how you can subscribe, call the Audio Journal offices at 508-797-1117.
This program is supported by the Worcester Memorial Foundation for the Blind, the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, and from generous contributions from listeners like you. Thank you. Our regular program schedule can be found on our website, audiojournal.org, or a printed version in large print or braille by calling the Audio Journal offices at 508-797-1117. Please remember, we need your feedback. How can we improve the program to better serve you, the listener? Call or email us with any suggestions or general feedback. We want to hear from you. This is Michael Houck.
And I'm Bob Golden. Thank you for listening. We hope you'll tune in again next week. Please stay tuned to Audio Journal. More great programming is coming your way.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
While digging for artifacts in the far north, Professor Quantum found a perfectly preserved body of a man. He was overjoyed. He believed the frozen body was none other than Adam from the Bible. What convinced Quantum of that?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
The body was missing what Adam would be missing, a belly button. What Quantum didn't know, however, is that a rare condition called umbilical aplasia causes some people, other than Adam, to be born without a belly button.
And now back to our regular programming.